This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. Before the show starts, I'd like to ask you to consider subscribing to News from Science. You've heard from some of our editors on here, David Grimm, Mike Price. They handle the latest scientific news with accuracy and good cheer, which is pretty amazing considering it can sometimes be over 20 articles a week. And you hear from our journalists. They're all over the world writing on every topic under the sun, and they come on here to share their stories. The money from subscriptions, which is about 50 cents a week, goes directly to supporting nonprofit science journalism, tracking science policy, our investigations, international news, and yes, when we find out new mummy secrets, we report on that too. Support nonprofit science journalism with your subscription at science.org/news. Scroll down and click subscribe on the right side. That's science.org/news. Click subscribe. This is the Science Podcast for September 30th, 2022. I'm Sarah Crespi. Each week, we talk about the most interesting news and research from Science and the sister journals. First up this week, we have staff writer Eric Stockstead. We're going to talk about why Spain has given personhood to a very polluted lagoon. Also on the show this week is researcher Genevieve Plant. We talk about measuring the unexpectedly large quantities of methane released by the oil and gas industry in a process called methane flaring. And in this month's installment of our series of books on the science of food and agriculture, host Angela Saini talks with author Jessica Harris about her book, High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. Now we have staff writer Eric Stockstead. He wrote this week about giving personhood to a lagoon in Spain. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Sarah.
We're talking about the saltwater lagoon Mar Menor, which is basically a little pinched off part of the Mediterranean. Eric, what made you interested in writing about this?
I did a story last year about one of the largest species of mussel in the sea, a bivalve, and it's in the Mediterranean. It's called the fan mussel or the pen shell. They had nearly 2 million of these in this lagoon in Spain. And when they had one of these anoxic events that was so bad, it killed 98% of them. So that's one of the reasons why last year the Spanish government said they were going to put several hundred million euros, they would spend that on trying to help address the problem.
That's how you came to the story?
Well, that's how I found out about Mar Menor, this lagoon. But the tale of it and how it's changed over the years through human actions, it's a fascinating place, Sarah.
So what's been causing the fish to die off in the lagoon?
This is not a rare problem. It comes from too much nutrients in the water that are coming from farms in the area. Fertilizer is not staying on the farm fields. It washes into the lagoon. Algae are consuming the nitrogen. So you get an algal bloom. And when the algae die, they are broken down by bacteria. And that bacteria is consuming the oxygen in the water. Often it's that lack of oxygen. If the fish can escape that, they die.
So this is something that they couldn't seem to manage through like more typical regulatory channels. And so the idea here is that giving personhood to the lagoon would somehow enable a different approach to fighting off this fertilizer runoff and the changing chemical composition of the lagoon?
Right. Both Spain and the European Union, of which Spain is a member, have environmental laws. They have water protection laws. And that just hasn't done the trick here. It's partly that the farm lobby, the political forces push back. Those laws haven't solved the problem. So the hope is that having legal rights for the lagoon, which provides a way for citizens to sue on behalf of the lagoon, could provide more momentum to clean up the water. It also provides some just a way of having sort of more continuous or constant political pressure to help improve the water. So it won't depend so much on which politician is in office in the local region. You have a group of representatives who are the decision makers for this, who have other input from other stakeholders.
What prompted the government to take those steps?
This was a popular referendum. I'm not sure that this has happened in this way before. So this chapter of the story starts last year after this lagoon had a particularly nasty fish kill, and a philosophy professor in the area thought that there had to be another way to help solve this problem. And with her advocacy, the idea for establishing legal rights for the lagoon and the surrounding basin started to gather steam. And I think more than 500,000 people in a referendum approved the idea. So then it went to the government, and last week it was officially approved.
What does it mean to convey personhood to a body of water?
It's a concept that sort of evolved for several decades. It's been around for a while. It comes from the idea that nature has intrinsic worth. It's not something that is owned by us or is property, but has its own worth. And in this sense, it has its own rights, like a person has rights to exist.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what does it mean to have personhood, you know, in the case of a lagoon?
It's the right to exist as an ecosystem. It's the right to evolve naturally. It includes all the communities of organisms and the soil of the lagoon itself and the basin around it.
It has rights that can be defended in court.
I think that's very commonly the case. That's not always the main purpose. For example, in New Zealand, the idea of declaring rights for nature is tied very closely to the Maori, to the indigenous people's cultural ideas about nature. So in that sense, it's not so much providing, you know, a place to litigate or to sue, but to acknowledge and to value that thinking and feeling about nature.
Really interesting. So we were talking about Spain. Now we're talking about Australia. Are the types of nature that they're giving personhood to in that country also bodies of water?
In Australia, they've done this with a river. Colombia, I think, had a river too. And India. And I think actually all the rivers in Bangladesh. Did we mention South America, Colombia, Ecuador? So I think, you know, protecting the Amazon is another goal.
So what's next for the lagoon? Is it immediately going to go to court and start suing people?
There's going to be a period to set up the body, the guardians, who will be advocating for the new rights of the lagoon, figuring out who's representing it. There's a process. Experts on the ecology of the lagoon will be nominated and will help inform these guardians. It'll take a while to get going. And I think the bigger question is whether this really does shift the overall political momentum. You know, shifting the balance of that region towards a healthier lagoon.
So Eric, you've talked to some experts about the lagoon. What do they think about this?
The people who study this are quite excited. You know, the two scientists I talked to today were hopeful, but a little skeptical. I think they've seen too little progress for too long. That makes them kind of cautious about it. For years, they've said as scientists, here's what the problem is and here's how you fix it. And the politicians just look the other way. So I think they are hopeful, but realistic that it's not something that'll change overnight. Some jurists in Spain were very excited about this. And certainly the people who have seen this happening in more and more places are excited that this is the first time that it's gotten traction in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay, let's do some imagining. All the major bodies of water, all the mountains and rivers have personhood and guardians. What does the world look like?
Can I say it depends?
Of course. I'm asking you to predict the future, right? Of course.
It depends on who those guardians are and how much power we, you know, human society gives them. If we do, I think it's a compromise, right? We have to give some things up. Some people have to give up more things than others. For this lagoon, farmers might have to scale back on the amount of fertilizer they're using. It's not clear that that would mean that they would grow less. People who run hotels or who are kayaking on the lagoon would have a healthier lagoon. I think worldwide, if we managed this, overall, people would benefit from having nature that's treated as well and as with as much respect as property that's owned. So yeah, I think we'd have a greener, healthier world, and overall people would benefit from that. But it's a long road to get there. But yeah, I think it's a great question, and keeping your eye on how things would get better, that's the way to get there.
Yeah. I mean, this is just a legal framework that is turning people's brains in a different direction, turning their thinking in a different direction when it comes to something that, as you say, no one really owns it, but it is a shared resource that we all appreciate when it comes to a mountain, a river, a lagoon.
That's right. Legal rights for nature, that's an idea, but so is property ownership.
Right.
That's also an idea. It's one that, you know, most people believe in pretty strongly. So it's about competing ideas with very real outcomes for people and for nature.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Great talking with you again, Sarah.
Eric Stockstead is a staff news writer for Science. You can find a link to the article we discussed at science.org/podcast. Up next, we have researcher Genevieve Plant. She talks about testing real-world efficiency of methane flaring. This is a practice of the oil and gas industry that's intended to reduce the release of this powerful greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. High above the Earth, there are these satellites constantly on the lookout for fires. They actually have sensors tuned to the wavelengths of fires from like a forest fire or a flare. So I'm talking about here methane flares. These are used by oil and gas industry to basically cut down on the release of methane during extraction and processing, because methane is such a powerful greenhouse gas. Now, down here on the ground, industry and regulators have been assuming that burning off methane in these situations is about 98% efficient, very little escaping into the atmosphere during these processes. But new data from research flights and ground-based detection suggests the picture is not so clean. Genevieve Plant is here to talk about a study published this week in Science on the efficiency of flaring. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sarah.
So satellites can detect fire from space. This is, first of all, was surprising to me.
Yes.
They can see these special wavelengths associated with fire, and they can detect methane flaring. But we can't tell from space how efficient these flares are.
Not yet, but yeah, they look for a heat signature at different spectral wavelengths and induce the heat of a flame. So it could be a flare, or like you said, fires and other things.
Why is flaring needed? I mean, why is there unwanted methane?
Flaring happens for a number of reasons. It could be a safety concern, so they could be emergency flares. natural gas is explosive. So if something is going wrong and you need to quickly disperse that so it's not explosive to the people in the immediate area, then you might do that. It may also be infrastructure limitations. So if your focus is mainly on oil, you might not have the infrastructure to pipeline that gas to further processing and then bringing it to the market. And there might just be a lack of economic incentive if you're focused mostly on the oil. So the regions in the U.S. that flare the most are those that focus on oil rather than gas.
This project involved flying planes through the air above active flares. So how close to the fire were the planes?
The small aircraft, the team in the air consisting of a pilot and a flight scientist, would fly in the order of like hundreds to a kilometer downwind at the same altitude as the plume coming off the flare. So it's fairly low, at least compared to, you know, what you're flying at cruising altitudes. We try to stay very close to the flare, not close enough that we're, you know, in danger of touching the flare at all, nothing like that, but such that we can easily connect what we see in the air to the flare on the ground.
So I saw there's a diagram of the plane's flight path, and it really looks like a spiral. Is that like a spiral that's parallel to the flare?
Yeah, so the combustion plume coming off the flare might be elevated a bit because of the heat, but yeah, so it's kind of on level with the plume coming off. We kind of nicknamed that the shifting race car track because sometimes it would take a bit of real-time fine-tuning to get to the right altitude to actually intercept that plume because it's fairly narrow.
Were you on any of these flights?
Not in this campaign, but I've been on the same kind of plane for other things.
What's that like?
It's fun. Flying low is bumpy, so you get a strong stomach eventually.
What can you tell about a flare from a flight like this? What kind of sensors did you have and what were they keying into?
The sensors we had on board were highly sensitive spectroscopic sensors. So these are optical sensors that are able to detect very low concentrations of gases because we're looking for very low changes in these concentrations of things like methane, carbon dioxide that are attributable like above the baseline. So when we intercept that plume downwind of the flare, we can see enhancements of carbon dioxide and methane. In a perfect world, it would be all carbon dioxide because the combustion from the flare would be destroying all the methane and all the other hydrocarbons. But from the relative enhancement of carbon dioxide and methane, we can tell how well the flare is destroying that methane. And that's a parameter that is called the destruction removal efficiency.
So how much methane is getting taken out, how much carbon dioxide is being produced? That's the destruction efficiency.
Yeah, and that 98 number you mentioned is a destruction removal efficiency. They're designed and accounted for as operating at 98% destruction removal efficiency, meaning 2% of the methane in the flare gas is leaked to the atmosphere under those assumptions.
For this paper, you divide the country into these different regions that are called basins. You know, what exactly are they?
We targeted the regions of the Bakken in North Dakota, the Permian in Texas and a bit in New Mexico, and then the Eagle Ford also in Texas. These are various shales and oil plays throughout the U.S. So these are the ones historically that have focused mostly on oil extraction. And then the flaring is the result of removing the associated gas that is produced when you're extracting the oil, but is not the main like economic target.
Let's talk about how many flights you did and what proportion of the flaring that is happening in the U.S. that you were able to get a look at.
So those three regions together account for over 80% of the flaring volumes in the U.S. because, again, these are regions that are predominantly focused on oil extraction rather than gas. So over the course of 2 years, we conducted two separate campaigns. In total, we had about 12 research flights, each around 5 or so hours. But what that allowed us to do was to intercept plumes coming off of 300 flares. Sometimes we would intercept them multiple times. So we got just about 600 intercepts of flare plumes for our data set.
Another concern here with methane releases is unlit flares. You know, this is basically like leaving a gas stove on, but never sparking it. And there's just gas streaming out and no ignition. How common is that and how are you able to account for that part of these methane releases?
You can't talk about methane from flares if you're not considering flares that are unlit. There's a growing amount of evidence that it's not uncommon. To account for that in our analysis of methane from flares in the U.S., we relied on a previous study characterizing the number of unlit flares in the Permian. In our work, we complemented that with a ground survey in the Bakken in North Dakota, doing something similar using an infrared camera, sampling a large number of flares and accounting, figuring out how many were unlit based on the infrared camera imagery.
So if you take into account the plumes that you were sampling and the rate of destruction there, and then these unlit flares, you know, what's the efficiency on average for these basins that you looked at?
So when we consider both those two categories of flares together, we found that the effective efficiency was closer to 91% as opposed to 98%, which is the standard used in accounting for flares currently.
This is percentage points, but is it a lot?
You know, yes.
Is that a lot of methane, you know, if we're just talking about a few percent here?
Yes, it is. And that's a good point to put it into different contexts. So it represents a fivefold increase in the amount of methane based on current assumptions. So yes, it's quite a big difference.
So five times more methane than we think is being released from all these sources. The U.S. is letting out that much more. What about the rest of the world? Like, I saw that there are plenty of these sources in Russia, in the Middle East. You know, is that also likely to be less efficient than we think?
Our data set was restricted to the U.S., so we really can't say a whole lot about the efficiency of lit flares without more data. So that's definitely an opportunity going forward. But there have been other studies based on satellite measurements that have identified large unlit flares around the world in these other regions of high flaring activity that you mentioned. So it starts to suggest that flaring isn't necessarily a perfect practice elsewhere as well.
How much methane over what we thought? Do you know what the value is for that?
This fivefold increase in flaring emissions equates to around 0.6 teragrams of methane per year. We estimate that that is around 4 to 10% of the whole oil and gas methane budget. In the paper, we did the calculation of if flares were able to perform at that 98% destruction removal efficiency, that would be the equivalent of taking just about 3 million cars off the road for each year that was achieved.
Wow. Okay. So this is a serious amount of methane that's being released without really being accounted for. Are there fixes for this? Are there ways to get better at flaring or maybe to just have fewer unlit flares?
With this data set, we can't really say what's causing it. And it's likely a variety of things. So that's kind of what the community is starting to focus on. But it could be a combination of things. It could be that there's certain operating conditions in these dynamic regions where things are changing over time that the flares are not designed to. So they may be operating out of their design parameter range. There may also be some maintenance practices and things like that that could be implemented. It will require further analysis to get to the root cause of a lot of this, but it seems like there are tangible solutions from an engineering perspective.
So what motivated you to do this kind of study?
So over the past couple of decades, there's been a lot of study and deployment of measurement campaigns to study methane and look at its sources. And many of those works identify the oil and gas sector as a large contributor of methane to our atmosphere. So these results indicate that how we're currently accounting for methane based in inventory methods doesn't really capture what's actually going on. But flaring, as that part of it, hasn't been updated, in part due to lack of data. So our aim was to fill in that data gap, because there's been a handful of studies looking at a couple flares that say, in the real world, they may be operating off this 98% number. So we went out to try to see if that is widespread or if it's just a handful of flares that you happen to study.
Thanks, Jenny.
Thanks, Sarah.
Genevieve Plant is an assistant research scientist at the University of Michigan in the Department of Climate and Space Sciences and Engineering. You can find a link to the paper we discussed at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for the fifth in our series on books exploring the science of food and agriculture. This month, host Angela Saney talks with celebrated food writer Jessica Harris.
Hello, I'm Angela Saney, science journalist, author, and the host of this special series of podcast segments speaking to the authors of unmissable books on food and agriculture. I'm thrilled today to be joined by one of America's most influential cookery writers, Dr. Jessica Harris, a former professor at Queens College, City University of New York for 5 decades. Harris's work documents the food and foodways of the African diaspora. She consults internationally, most recently for the New York Botanical Gardens, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the cafeteria of the Smithsonian Museum of African American Culture and History. Harris's 2011 book, High on the Hog, is a historical journey from the kitchens, farms, and markets of Africa through the trauma of the Middle Passage and the horrors of slavery to the complex and profound ways in which African cuisines have shaped how Americans eat today. Her work proves how vital it is for scientists who are interested in food, agriculture, and nutrition to really appreciate the role of culture and politics. Dr. Harris, it is such a pleasure to have you here. Could you just start by explaining the origins of the title of your book, High on the Hog? Where does that come from?
Well, it's really kind of simple. It comes from the old Master and John stories that are sort of trickster tales out of the experiences of the enslaved. And it's one about Master and John, John being the enslaved person and sometimes the trickster. He likes getting over on old Master. So it's about hog killing time. Master would come down, knock on John's door and say, John, meet me at the back 40 tomorrow morning around 4 a.m., 5 a.m. We're killing hogs and I need you to be there to help. And John says, well, what do you give me, Master? And Master says, well, I'll give you the head and the tails and all of the feet and I'll give you a bucket of guts. And John says, all right, see you at the time. And that goes on for years and years and years and decades until John finally gets his own hogs. And Master doesn't know this. So he comes down, he knocks on the door as usual, and as per usual says, you know, meet me in the back 40, it's hog killing time. And John says, well, what'll you give me, Master? And Master says, what I always give you, the head, the tails, the feet, bucket of guts. And John rears kind of back and says, oh, I don't rightly think so. I've got my own hogs now, and I am eating bacon and ham and pork chops and Midland and spare ribs and all kinds of stuff. I'm eating higher on the hog now. So the expression higher on the hog, literally not the hoof, not the feet, but the ham, higher on the hog.
I mean, that story really encapsulates one of the themes of your book, which is power. And power dynamics are an important part of social science research and telling the history of American food. You really show how crops were cultivated through the brutal exploitation of slave labor, how cuisines were created and adapted by imaginative enslaved cooks, and then those same cuisines adopted by Southern housewives and white Americans so completely that their roots are forgotten. Can you disentangle some of this for us?
Well, I mean, I think you've said it rather eloquently. It's if you think about enslavement, if you think about it, certainly I talk about it in United Statesian terms, if you will, it is absolutely hemispheric. It is the same thing, certainly from America all the way south. America being United States of America all the way south. The thing is that enslaved Africans were the agricultural workers. They were the people who processed the food. They were the people who cooked the food. And they very deliberately were brought here to do just that. So if you really just parse it out and think about it for a minute, what we're talking about is a multi-layered level of exploitation, which ultimately, if you flip it around, gave the enslaved Africans total power over the agricultural and culinary realms of the hemisphere. So that's kind of how the story goes.
And that's a very interesting part of this story from a scientific perspective, because of course, anthropologists and agricultural scientists are always interested in understanding how and why various food crops spread around the world, how they got there. And you explore how the transatlantic slave trade, as well as the people, brought new crops and cuisines to the Americas. Most significantly, I was very surprised to learn, rice.
Absolutely. Rice surprises people because we tend to think of rice in Asia. And most people don't know that the continent of Africa has its own rice. It's Oryza glabirima as opposed to Oryza sativa. And it has been cultivated there. It is native to the continent. It has been cultivated there for centuries, if not millennia. I think one of the things that we tend to discount, and I'm going to say something that's sort of backhandedly, perhaps a compliment, not meant as a compliment, but the wisdom, if you will, of slave traders and those who were enslaving people, they knew more about African cultures than we do today.
Because they had to.
Well, it was part of the economics of the institution. They had to, and they did, so that they knew that there were people who knew how to grow rice. And those were specifically, and particularly the people that they went to get, to capture, to kidnap, to bring to this hemisphere to exploit. So that that rice growing knowledge, not necessarily the rice itself, but that rice growing knowledge was at the basis of all of the great fortunes made in the Carolinas on rice and in the Low Country. So Carolina to Georgia, all of that area.
It was surprising for me because I, you know, as someone recently transplanted to the US, I'd eaten West African food before I'd ever had Southern food. But when I went to New Orleans this year, I was astounded at what commonalities there were between West African food and the kind of food eaten in New Orleans. And you write in your book about okra, black-eyed peas, certain kind of seasonings. Can you describe their story from Africa to the United States and how we can trace those roots?
Gosh, I think that's the book. But okay. You know, I mean, for example, okra, which is also a thing that is indigenous to the continent, comes over to the United States and gets connected with, certainly with New Orleans and southern Louisiana via gumbos. And Uchingombo and Kingombo are one of the names for the vegetable in the southern, well, east, southwestern sort of Central Africa, Angola and places like that. But so what happens is you get these plants that come over. It is more evident in parts of the Caribbean than it is in the United States because of climate. But what you find is that you get these things that then go on to become totemic foods. Anybody that goes to New Orleans wants to have a gumbo. Gumbo named for the Uchingombo. Everybody that goes to Charleston wants to have a red rice for the rice that was transplanted. So the foods that become emblematic of their varying regions, particularly in the southeastern United States, are those foods that were created from those crops brought or at least nurtured agriculturally by the enslaved Africans.
That process of learning that you go through and your readers go through definitely comes through in your book. But for the benefit of our listeners, what has it been like for you over decades to, but you've visited various parts of Africa for many, many years. How did it feel to see these connections and research them?
It absolutely feels transformational. I honestly don't remember a lot of what it felt like. But I do know that on my very first trip to Western Africa, I went with my mother. So that was a generational thing for me and also a confirming thing because we could look at each other and go, oh, that tastes like. And my mother had extraordinary taste. She was a trained dietitian and probably had better taste buds and better tasting faculties than I do. So it was kind of lovely and now in hindsight, very important that she be with me on that first trip because between the two of us, we could make connections.
And something that struck me when I was reading your book was also it parallels experiences I've had in India of just how careful people are about using everything, you know, not allowing any part of meat or vegetable to go to waste. And as you explain, the title of your book, The Hog, The Pig, here is a process in which every part of the animal is being used out of necessity. And one of the people you mention is a Harlem Renaissance character known as Pigfoot Mary. Can you describe this kind of head-to-trotter cookery and what lessons it might have for food scientists and nutritionists today?
Well, I mean, I think that we are now hearing about nose-to-tail eating. It's become quite trendy. I believe if you go back into the cookery of old France, not the professional cookery, but the family cookery, the farm cookery, you see all of those things happening. I mean, the laughing, sort of humorous African-American expression is we eat everything on the pig from the rooter to the tooter. So that we have that whole idea of and the whole notion of nose to tail. Literally, I have been in some of the old kind of backside of the road convenience stores or sometimes even a barbecue stand in Mississippi, and you'll see a great multi-gallon jug filled with pig snouts, pickled pig snouts. And it's a delicacy, pig's feet. It's the same as with, well, chicken feet, those little teeny tiny bones in the pig's foot. There's nothing more satisfying than gnawing on those bones. So it's certainly practical in that it keeps down food waste, but it also has its own gustatory side as well. I mean, there is a delight taken in gnawing, which is a culinary verb we don't use much in the Western world, but that idea of gnawing on a bone, enjoying that is part of it. So it's not just done out of necessity to not waste. There is a great deal of, for want of a better word, glee taken in doing some of that.
Absolutely. I can see the pleasure that someone could get from that. You do, at the end of your book, you have a list of recipes. It's not a recipe book, but there are recipes at the end there, each of which illustrates an aspect of the history that you describe. Which is your personal favorite there?
Oh, goodness, I have no idea. Honestly, I no longer remember what recipes are included. But I know that there is a kind of quick Brazilian-style collard greens, which is kind of like what they would call couve. And couve is one of the accompaniments to a traditional feijoada. Most people, certainly in the States, are astounded to find out that collard greens are not African in origin because they have become so emblematic of African-American food. Collard is a corruption of colewort. Colewort is any non-heading cabbage. And it is basically a Northern European green. The cooking process, the cooking them long, low, and slow, as someone said in a letter to me once, until they wink back at you. But the cooking them long, low, and slow with a seasoning piece of meat and the consumption of the pot liquor being the liquid in the pot, that's the Africanism. It's not the green. So they are actually a transference. They are something that makes something European into or connect with some techniques or tastes from the continent.
And finally, what do you hope that scientists in particular will take away from your book?
I hadn't really thought of scientists per se when I was writing the book, but I think that the thing that I would like everyone to take away is perhaps be more open. Don't assume that it is linear, because it's probably not. Try to connect the dots. And the dots may not be evident. Try to expect the unexpected and see those things that might be just slightly beneath the surface. I guess in another way, scientists can be very, I don't want to say dogmatic, but it's science. So that there is a methodology, there is a way, there is all of that. I would say every once in a while, step out of that and take a long look at it and see if that changes the view. It might.
Dr. Harris, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Take care.
And from me, Angela Saini, that's all until next month when we'll have the final episode of this series. I'll be speaking to Dan Saladino, author of Eating to Extinction. See you then.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can listen to the show on the Science website at science.org/podcast or search for Science Magazine on any podcasting app. This show was edited and produced by Sarah Crespi with production help from Podigy, Kevin McLean, Angela Saney, and Megan Cantwell. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.